The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on April 28, 2024. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Good to see you. Well, this past week, I was visiting with some friends. They've been studying Nagarjuna, the Mulumbajamaka Karika, and we're up to chapter 24. And I can't remember now if they invited me or if I invited myself or whatever. It was on a Zoom discussion. In fact, they're probably watching right now. Anyway, it was just wonderful, refreshing for me to get back to Nagarjuna. Chapter 24, that's an examination of the Four Noble Truths. And probably the high point in the Mulumbajamaka Karika. Anyway, one of the verses in that chapter, verse 14, we didn't get to it in our discussion the other day, but always been one that really affected me. Most of you, well, those of you who have studied Nagarjuna, I'm sure you're quite familiar with this verse. Here, Nagarjuna says, to those for whom emptiness is clear, everything is clear. To those for whom emptiness is not clear, nothing is clear. And that probably sounds like hyperbole. When you think about it, think about what he's saying there. It's not hyperbole, I can assure you of that. But it sounds like it. And plenty of people have said this about whatever their thing is, that this is everything. Everything's cleared up with this understanding, with this belief, with this idea. That is not what Nagarjuna is saying. He's not talking about the idea of emptiness, that you're clear on the idea of emptiness. If you have some idea of emptiness and you're building everything and all your understanding on that, this is already confusion. There's nothing there that is holding up from moment to moment upon which you're going to build your belief structure, your understanding of the world or your experience. Nothing is clear. When we have ideas about reality or what is true or right or about these teachings or anything at all in life, and we think that this is true or that is true. I remember once my teacher said, kind of in passing, and we all laughed. I've mentioned this many times. But he said in an evening talk, I think it was, at one point, he says, whatever you think is delusion. And we all kind of chuckled, me too. I didn't quite realize the depth of what he was just pointing out there. But almost in passing, he looked surprised when we laughed. Whatever you think is delusion. And I realized later, maybe more to the point, whatever you believe, whatever you think is true, you're holding to that truth, that idea, and this is delusion. And with that, nothing is clear. You might feel like, well, I'm clear on this point that I'm holding here. Well, continue to investigate that. If you do, sooner or later, in your mind, just your mind alone, you can sense some instability there. And the reason for this is, it's because we can't capture reality in conceptual thought, with an intellectual understanding. And yet this is where we always go. It's what we've relied on our whole lives for pretty much everything. We try to get an idea, a conceptual understanding of what's being said or what's being pointed out, but more importantly, of what is even being directly experienced. We have to get it into some kind of a thought or an idea, then we feel more comfortable if I have an idea, this, and if I happen to really believe this, I really think that this concept, this idea, this picture I have in my mind of whatever it might be, is true. Ah, I see, now I understand. You have something like this. The backdrop of your mind now is just swimming in mystery and confusion. And nothing is clear to you. And this is how it is for most of us, pretty much all the time. Even though we don't realize this, we think, I have my truth, whether it's a religious truth or a political truth or anything else. What's true for me? This is helpful for me, and I want this, you know, whatever it might be. And we're grasping it, holding to it, and we think that this has something to do with reality, or there's some expression of reality. Well, it is, but not in terms of what you're holding. Not at all. Nothing is clear in your mind, really, at this point. And if you were to investigate any corner of it, you might begin to uncover this. But Nagarjuna says, to those for whom emptiness is clear, everything is clear. But to those for whom emptiness is clear, they don't have any idea of emptiness, as if emptiness were a thing. But that's what we do with everything, pretty much. We make it into things. Ben Connolly was here some, he's been here a number of times, but he, a while back, he wrote a book on the, what is it, the 30 verses of Vasubandhu. I forget the title of his book now. I didn't know I was going to mention this, but I just happened to think of it now. But he mentioned here, when he's talking about, I guess, when he came out with that book, that Vasubandhu puts everything, well, he expresses everything in terms of things, makes everything into a thing. And we like that. Because now it's a thing, it's an idea, it's an enclosed thing, separated from other things, distinguished from other things or ideas or impressions or feelings in various ways. And we like that because it makes us feel like, well, we're getting hold of something, we're getting hold of the truth. But this Nagarjuna is pointing out to us, and this is why we tend not to like Nagarjuna or find Nagarjuna very difficult, because he points out that the moment we do that, that we take hold of even emptiness itself, that taking hold of is non-empty. By turning things into things, we, well, are taking hold of all of that which is not emptiness. It is thingness. It is something separated out from other things that we can grasp or identify with, take hold of. Yeah, I believe this, I think this, therefore I'm a Buddhist, say. That's a complete misunderstanding of the Buddha's teaching. Anything you take hold of in that way, this isn't Buddha Dharma. You can't take hold of direct experience, a direct seeing of reality. There's nothing to take hold of there, but there is understanding. If you see that, this is the correct understanding. And everything now is clear, including mind and consciousness, why we have this confusing world. And thinking about what I was going to say today, I remember when I was a kid, well, I was an older kid. But I used to like Harry Belafonte, and I had a few of his LPs. And on this one LP, he had this song, I forget the name of the song exactly, but it's about a little child who's asking his father, you know, why? And then he ends up, well, then the father, then he asks the actual question or two, or, you know, It might seem kind of silly, a little boy asking some questions. Why can't a mouse eat a streetcar? Is one of them. But then it gets into maybe pointing into deeper things. And so at some point, the father just says to the little boy, he says, because I don't know the answers. You know, there's a person says, why? Well, because. But because I don't know the answers. Yeah, and that's kind of where we are. We might think we have the answer. We'll hold it for a while or maybe for many years. And at some point we might see about this particular issue, whatever it might be, well, that doesn't hold up. But this will be the case if you pursue anything like that at all that you grasp. You will realize that you do not understand what you've taken hold of here. And when we try to do that with our life experience and with the world around us and other people and all of this, taking hold of all of this as if we know that we have the answer, we could put it into words and say how it is. You know, you're confused, and this is the right way here, even though 10 years ago, you know, I've thought something like that, and 10 years from now, I'll be thinking something else. We don't notice all of that, but at any given moment, we feel like we do know something. Yeah, well, we do. Conceptually, we can know things in a limited way, in a relational way with other things, and that's very functional and useful. There's nothing wrong with that. The error we make as human beings is that we believe whatever it is we might be holding for the moment. We actually have it formed in some way in our mind that we have an object there, a thing. We've turned it into a thing. And what Nagarjuna is trying to help us to see that the moment you do that, no, nothing is clear. Because for you, you see, emptiness, when he says that to those for whom emptiness is clear, everything is clear, to those for whom emptiness is not clear, well, what we've done now is we've made this emptiness into something non-empty. We made it into a thing, in other words. Oh, now I can see it, and I can grasp it, I can use it. And that makes us feel pretty good. Makes us feel like we're getting somewhere. And to some limited degree in the relative world between issues of this and that, sure, it can be very functional and useful. But we make the error of thinking that we've captured reality. We've captured truth with a capital T. And this is where we go wrong. I have a quote, I came upon this quote recently, by Albert Einstein. And I found this to be interesting, might help to illustrate some of what I'm trying to say here. He says, I have repeatedly said that in my opinion, the idea of a personal God is a childlike one. But I do not share the professional atheist fervor for battling theism, whose enthusiasm mainly stems from the painful liberation process from the religious indoctrinations of youth. I prefer an attitude of humility corresponding to the weakness of our intellectual understanding of nature and of our own being. This is Albert Einstein. I thought that was pretty good. In fact, I felt that that was a bit of my understanding and my experience too. I was brought up in a pretty strict Christian home and indoctrinated in various ways with certain ideas, beliefs. Until about the time I was 12 or so, I started to realize that some of these ideas were conflicting with other things that I had studied and thought about and understood in my mind at that time. These were known to me to be true, but that conflicted with some of the teachings in the church I was being raised in. And that bothered me for a bit. But eventually, I guess I kind of rebelled against that. I didn't do it in a... and I came to, like he says, shared the idea of a personal God, something kind of... it's a childlike idea. And I came to see it in that way, I think, pretty much myself. But still, emotionally, it had some grip on me, my ties to that kind of thinking that I was raised in, till I was probably in my early 20s, when I was finally able to break free of that. But I was gripped by other kinds of ideas. I dove into science and into philosophy as well, looking for that which I could really hang on to, getting to the truth intellectually, to really understand this is what I wanted. I wanted to understand what is going on here, make some sense of this. And maybe for a moment I was like Einstein here, where he said, but I do not share the professional atheist's fervor for battling theism. Well, I think maybe for a brief moment I did share that fervor. Until I started to see that the same kind of dogmatic gripping of, what can I say, faulty thoughts, ideas, were even there among the atheists. Of course, people define atheism in different ways. Atheism is like no God belief. I've heard that, but when you really think about it, though, it is kind of, but it's just like what Einstein says here, that the professional atheist, he talks about their fervor for battling theism, whose enthusiasm mainly stems from the painful liberation process from religious indoctrinations of youth. And I realized that that was what I was feeling when I first kind of crossed over like that, and I was sort of angry, maybe, fighting back against those kinds of beliefs that I was kind of fed to me as a defenseless child, where I intellectually couldn't argue. I just swallowed stuff. But maybe some anger there. And I've noticed that then with many people who, I used to subscribe to the Skeptical Inquirer, if you know of that, and also Inquiry magazine. And very often that's what the kind of arguments are. They're arguments fighting back against, in our culture, mainly Christian indoctrination, that sort of thing. But this isn't very, very helpful. I'd learned this pretty early on. It isn't helpful. And it started to look more and more like we're all caught up in our thinking and in our believing and then in our counter-beliefs. And it all seemed confused to me. Like we were all very confused. And it was sort of like that why and why and why and why. Well, because, and then we come up with our little answers. But nothing was grounded in anything here at all. And when I focused my attention on one point or another, here or there, whether it was in terms of religious beliefs or even scientific, science isn't really based on beliefs, so they say it is a method of uncovering truth. But as I investigated, a lot of the conclusions that we come to, we're still left with why. Why and why and why? Why are we always left with a why? I wanted to know. Well, here, and I was going to say this too, when Einstein goes on here, he said, I prefer an attitude of humility corresponding to the weakness of our intellectual understanding of nature. There's Einstein. The weakness of our intellectual understanding of nature and of our own being. Yeah, why are we so weak in this area? We have learned a great deal through science and technology and all of this, how to manipulate the world, produce food for ourselves and all sorts of things, and of course to pollute the planet and then of course the systems that we have of economics and how people can make a lot of money doing damaging things and gain political power to control it, to hold that kind of ability, that power in their hands. against what is clearly helpful for the welfare of not just human life on this planet, but life on this planet. It's just mass confusion everywhere. And I was like, nobody knows the answers. Like the poor father finally says to the little boy, because I don't know the answers. Yeah. And we will not know the answers as long as we keep what we're pursuing is to get the idea, to get the right concept, the right belief. There is no such thing as that. True understanding, the way that Nagarjuna speaks of it here, points it out, this is the seeing and the realizing of emptiness. Well, shunyata is the term he used. It gets translated that this way. In my latest book, I translated that word as non-substantiality. But until we see that as empty, devoid of any kind of, well, whatever it is, it's devoid of any kind of substantiality. And as my teacher said, whatever you think, whatever you grasp, whatever you take hold of here, this is delusion. Until we see that, until we truly know that, we're going to be caught by any number of things. And we will fight, and we will live in fear or trembling, get overly excited about this or that and want to push it through in all sorts of ways that may, in the end, not really help anyone, including ourselves. So this, to me, started to become really the crux of the whole thing. Not going to find the answers in science, not going to find it through religion, not going to find it through philosophy. And yet, it always seemed that there is truth. There is reality. This isn't nothing. Sometimes people interpret Nagarjuna's emptiness as nothingness. That is clearly not correct. At first, I was wondering when I first started studying Nagarjuna, is this what he's talking about? But no, there's something else there. And indeed, there is something else that he's pointing out here. This nothingness, this emptiness he's speaking of, is not nothingness. It is not somethingness, because were it to be somethingness or thingness of some kind, this would be to take what it is that he's trying to help us see, point out to us, and putting it now into another form. That we could say, well, this is the truth. This is what you need to believe. This is what you need to grasp. This is what you need to build your life upon. And that's fine. Maybe we can go for the next 60 years that way if we're young. You reach the end of the road there, and we can still hang on to the beliefs tightly and die peacefully, maybe. Otherwise, we can realize that whatever it is, as Katagiri Roshi said to me, or to us, whatever you think, whatever you believe, whatever you hold on to, this is delusion. So what is going on with the Buddha Dharma? What is it that Nagarjuna is pointing to? If it isn't to ultimately then get the right idea, the right concept, the right way to put the world together in my mind so I understand it, but as a collection of things and thoughts and feelings, but some way to construct it or to have it make sense. And this is what we need to see is this is where we go wrong. It is through our very wanting to grasp something or to put it into a form of some sort, put a name on it now, a label, that we constantly throw ourselves back into mystery, into confusion, into a lack of understanding. On the surface, we might feel like, oh, now I get it. I mean, we're pretty happy with that. Maybe we can hold this religious belief, this childlike one, and a loving fatherly figure in heaven or whatever. That's great if you can Well, actually, it isn't great. But if you could hang on to that, it would seem okay right up to your death. But it is somewhat childlike. And if we keep looking for something out there that I can get hold of or that will take care of me or something, deep in the recesses of our minds, if there is such a thing as that, there is doubt. And with that doubt, swimming with that doubt is, you know, confusion and fear and lack of ease about just this and what's taking place here. Nagarjuna is pointing to freedom from this kind of, what can I say, oppression, this kind of bondage, being locked in a situation where it seems like there's no way out, and I have no choice but to grab this or that to hold me or sustain me, or, oh, as long as I can, and that's falling apart, I'll find another thing here. Or we end up despairing. Then we look to, what, to end it all for ourselves. People go that route too. Thinking that you know something there, that you're even willing to take your own life for it. Not entertaining the thought that, you know, this isn't knowing. This isn't understanding. This isn't the situation that we're in. The situation we're in is that we live in this world of emptiness. We have that expression, may we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. Nothing surpasses the boundless mind. Thus we bow to Buddha, the understanding of a Buddha, which is that this is a world of emptiness itself. And from this we can begin to realize that this emptiness, far from it falling apart into nothingness, is just the opposite of that. Whatever constructed thing you have there, it will fall apart and rot and die away. Whatever, even thoughts and ideas, as well as things. And there is no final peace or understanding with that understanding. And it is confusion. It is delusion. And nothing is clear in a mind that sees things in that way. But were we to see emptiness, that this becomes clear, that we don't actually have these solid things in opposition to each other or competing with each other or assisting each other, or whatever it might be. What we actually have is this dynamic reality where nothing is holding still for a moment. Nothing is enduring for a moment, but this dynamic that is continuously unfolding. This is life, this is reality, and it is reality as a whole. There's nothing outside of this, in other words. There's nothing apart from this. This is all it ever is. I'm going to say, too, that we now know science has gotten to a point, science and math has brought us to a point where they even realize now, I don't know where we're going to go with this after this, but it's not just that these things are empty of any kind of solid structure, you know, the physical things, but time and space itself. What is time or space? What are these things? Already rather tenuous, and yet they now realize that these are not fundamentally real either. That they're constructed of other things. Don't have a clear grip on what those things are yet, though they have names for them, some of them that they're discovering. They're mathematical forms. So this is where we're at. This is why I say if you investigate anything far enough, you're going to wander into territory where you actually aren't holding anything. But we don't have to go that far. Nagarjuna didn't know anything about where modern mathematics and science is getting us. He could see this himself directly. I could tell you myself that if we were to really see what is unfolding here, what is taking place here, that there's nothing to grip except for momentary usefulness of something in a limited way. That's perfectly fine. But for a real understanding, the full understanding, where we now can find peace and at easiness about the world and about our lives and the things that are taking place around us and all the insanity now that human beings, we've always been in, but we're through our technology and all this, we're getting so powerful now and our numbers are so great in the world. But if you see that as solid, this is how it really is. That's its ultimate nature. It's going to be terrifying. If I try to see it in those terms like I used to, yeah, it's rather terrifying. But it is possible to see this in a radically different way, and where there's no confusion, where everything is clear. You will see that everything is, one could say, mind. Of course, in putting a word to it, right, we're inching back into the problem that we always suffer from, as if mind were a thing. Mind with a capital M. Not my mind, because already me and my mind, this is already pretty vague. At least for me now. But what isn't vague is just this, what is unfolding here. And were we to actually get a glimmer of the true nature of what is taking place here, that there's nothing here for you to take hold of, nothing for you to construct an identity out of, you begin to see that doing such things as that, this is bondage. This is you tying yourself into a very painful circumstance. Tie yourself in so tightly that you can't even imagine a way to be released from it. And this is where many of us are. But it's simply a matter of notice your mind, notice your grasping mind, and realize that whatever you're holding on to there, in a limited way, it might be helpful and useful, that's fine. It gets to the point where it begins to hurt, or I feel like I'm tied up, constricted here, I'm confused. I want to know why and why and why and why, with no answers, no solid answers coming back. Just the childish answers that might satisfy me in my childish mind, but as I dig deeper, they won't satisfy. It is possible for us to realize the error of living this way, always needing to rely on my intellect, my conceptualizing ability to get myself out of trouble or to move on or whatever. And again, this is why we have teachings such as Dogen and Fukan Sasenge, where he says, cease from practice based on intellectual understanding. And this is why they would talk this way. Wang Po too, I know he's got plenty of them. At the moment I'm blanking out, but there's plenty of these statements in our teachings. This is what the awakened people are pointing to for us. You don't need to grip this. And another thing too, people have trouble with Nagarjuna. And I was there at first, though I kept powering through because there was something in this I had to understand. But it seems like it's such a heavy intellectual endeavor. So deep. Some of it is the language from ancient times and from a different culture. And that could pose some trouble there. But beyond that, it seemed like his thoughts were so deep. Well, at some point I started, because I'd had some philosophy, background, I could start to see that what he's doing, he's pointing out what other people say in their confusion. They'll say this or they say that, and he's correcting the erroneous understandings of things. He's pointing out the limitations, and it isn't like he himself is planting something so intellectually difficult to grasp. It's nothing like that at all in Nagarjuna. He's taking the intellectually entangled thoughts and ideas and constructs that we have, particularly as was forming in Buddhism at the time, and showing how these don't work, that's all. So it might seem kind of complicated in that way, because he's pointing out what we're doing. The unenlightened, I guess, the people with conventional minds, what we do, how we complicate things. Seeing what it is I've been trying to help point out this morning, but in just seeing, it's just that, it's just seeing. It isn't doing anything about it, it's just realizing what's actually taking place. There's nothing to build on it, you know, because the moment we do that, we're taking hold of something, and you didn't notice that. Well, wait a minute now, but you just created a solid thing here. You're going to use this to... That's what you need to see. That's as simple as that, to see that you never really get hold of anything. Whatever we think is delusion, as my teacher said. That doesn't mean don't think. We need to think. We need to conceptualize in limited ways. Be clear on that, too. This isn't throwing all of that away. This is not throwing anything away. This is about finally understanding the nature of what is unfolding here. And there is no objectively real thing or subjectively real thing or entity, such as me here, that can be gotten hold of. These things are appearances, and with the appearances, now there's coming, the appearances of coming and going, or looks like coming, looks like going, tathagata. So this is what our teachings, they're pointing to something very subtle in this way. And Nagarjuna is a master at helping to bring this out. That's why I taught Nagarjuna here for a number of times. I went through the whole Mula Majjhimaka Karika 6 times over the time I was here as head teacher. And then the reason I wanted to do that was to give you a kind of a base from which you can really understand where the correct teachings are coming from. And it is in this, having some sense of this matter of shunyata, emptiness, that it's not nothingness, that it's just thus, immediately, here. I'm not getting any ideas about it. I have no idea of emptiness. But it's just a matter of when you see whatever we encounter, it's empty of the substance we might otherwise give to it. That we can become familiar with in time, if we actually see it. The whole time you also have to be watching your mind, noticing the gripping that is going on in your mind. It's easily done. Easily done that we grip. It's not, maybe not so easily done that we finally start to see that for what it is. Okay. Well, maybe I've said enough. Got a little late start here, but I don't know. Guess there's anything else on that. Slip my hand here. Any questions, though, about what I said here this morning? Yeah, Paul.
Yeah,
you
said more about common.
Yeah.
That whatever you think is delusion.
Mm-hmm.
As I was really stood up to me as an important teaching for years here. And today I heard you kind of make a addition or slightly different way and wherever you believe is delusion.
Mm-hmm.
And that always seemed to be like a missing piece in that statement, because immediately when I think whatever you think is delusion, then I always think, well, thinking's bad. Yeah. That's where my mind used to go.
Yeah. Well, we also think delusion is bad. Delusion is not bad.
Yeah. And so
there's no room for good or bad here.
Yeah. And so that extra piece, whatever you believe, you know, it's just that holds up that grasp piece.
And belief, and we can clarify that a little bit too, that belief is thinking whatever you think is true. Okay, so if I think such and such, meaning if I believe such and such, I think that such and such is true. That's a belief. So it's the thinking that we grip as, this is it, this is true. That's the delusion. Yeah. We can think things. Like I think that when I get up to leave, I'll I'll head that way. And it's fine. I might still walk into the wall because I'm not paying attention, but, and they say, well, then that's true, that, in some limited way, we do talk about small t truth, yeah. Yeah, these things are, our appearances are true enough, but ultimately, this isn't true. This isn't what's going on. Science is now telling us that even time and space aren't true. They seem to be made of other things. What are those? And that's why I was saying that if we just pursue whatever it is we think is true, we will get to a point where it's kind of but when are we going to finally say that, actually, I haven't gotten hold of anything here? And at that point, we can begin to realize what mind is, what consciousness is, what life is, what the dynamic of living is, all of this. Without gripping any of it, we don't have to grip it. But it is because we do grip things that we suffer and create all kinds of painful circumstances for ourselves.
Well, I'm pretty sure I understand what you're saying, but as I'm interpreting it, you're really talking about some ultimate principle.
No.
Let me just give you an example.
So okay.
When he was a young man, Jacques Kimura used to often refer to this idea of three poisonous mountains. Three poisonous minds.
Three poisonous minds. Okay. Yeah.
So, that we're always wanting things, grasping at things. Another one being that we're also pushing things away. And then the corrective to those two things. But the third part of this is so important. And we're always in delusion. So, he used that a lot. And I, right down to the present time, I think that's a you can call it beliefs or ideas. To me, these are something that describe usefully human nature. Saying that would be okay because they're small t truths.
We could call it that. But these are totally abstract ideas. But they could be functional and useful and helpful.
They function very well.
Everything I did today, I'm using words to do it. And all of those entangled take concepts along with them and that sort of thing. So it isn't that there's something wrong with our conceptualizing, or we need to do this. And another thing Katagiri said to me when I first started to understand this, and then he wanted me to start giving more talks and things, and I said, well, we can't talk about this. and that's when he said, you have to say something. He said, if you don't say anything, then nobody will understand. So you have to say something, even though we can't say it. But we can talk in a way that might help to draw our attention to something that's vital that we need to notice about life here, what's being lived on.
I'm just asking because sometimes as you say these words, it almost sounds like you're saying, and I don't think you are, but I just want to clarify, sometimes you'll say you can't grasp anything. I think if you're going to function in this world successfully for a long time, you're going to have a lot of ideas about how to, like things like you can't spend more money than you have to spend and so on. We need a whole set of these things, not just a few, to get through a long life here successfully. And denying any of that. You're talking about don't hold on to some ultimate idea that explains the universe or whatever.
Well, also just to realize the futility of even trying to do that.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. But there are other things that, like don't spend more money than you have. Yeah, but that's just sound advice, this is another talk, but kind of related to thoughts of good and evil, which I could have gone that way today, but I didn't. But having ideas that are functional and useful, that's perfectly fine. The trouble is when we take hold of them, And then when we take hold of ideas, another thing that's starting to come into the picture now is that some of these things are good. And of course, the things that I tend to hang on to myself, I'll say are good, though other people might not agree with that. But now there's all kinds of trouble starting to well up as a result of this. So don't take anything too tightly. Loosen your grip on pretty much everything. Yeah. But it doesn't mean throw it away, because we have to move through this world of this and that, and through meeting other people and speaking and, you know, things like this. But when you form an identity, you take hold that this is true and this is right, and you, what you're doing is wrong. I mean, pretty soon the ego is building up, and we're getting caught up in anger and irritation. And there's no need for any of this. If we truly see the empty nature of the various things, you know, some of these things. Oh, and then so the basis of morality then would come in starting to see what is conducive to turning our minds toward wholeness, and what brings us more into personalized stuff, or selfishness, or, you know, what's good for me, or what's good for my tribe, or whatever, you know. Those things are not helpful. Those things lead to pain and suffering, you know. So it's not a matter of, don't say that my stuff is good or your stuff is good. Stop that kind of thinking. It's not necessary, it's not fruitful. What is fruitful, though, is to notice what's conducive to the whole, or toward turning our attention to the whole, in which here's where we will find peace. It's like the saying we have outside the door here, above the door, if you've noticed, was by Rumi, was it? And out beyond, beyond ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there is a field. I will meet you there. And some people have come to me, yeah, but he was Muslim, you know. It's pointing to something that's very much directing our attention to truth. It's of this nature. You know, it's beyond this field of right doing and wrong doing and good and bad. Now we can talk. We can go out to that field. And this is the Dharma field. That's why I chose that thing. You know, the Dharma field is the field of totality, wholeness. It's, and we can make symbols of it, like in this little robe here, or the full priest robe or whatever. It's a symbol of Dharma. And I have trouble with that, because now we're, well, trouble, I don't know. I'm not warring against it or anything like this, because there's something positive things we could say about it, you know. But it's also easy for, I've been sensitive to, because of my own experiences, how easily we're pulled by this or that. You know, we get caught by this and that. And so if we have the robes and all the different rituals and things, you know, there's a lot of stuff. When I was studying in Japan, I learned a lot. I left most of it behind because I didn't find it helpful. I wanted to help people wake up and get sane. And too much of this stuff, we could easily get lost in that. And that might feel comforting in some way, because we're lost in it, and it's beautiful if we finally accept it. And, yeah, I understand. But we can still remain confused, and that's where the real pain and the suffering is. And this is what I wanted to help people with. So, and that's kind of, you know, the way I was operating things here. But I'm not saying it's right. We should not wear these robes or whatever. There's more now. People are interested in that, yeah, in some limited way. That'd be fine, sure. But traps and snares are everywhere. And this is why I say watch your mind. Start to notice when you're getting caught by the, oh, I want that. Well, that would be so good. Yeah, and maybe so in some limited way. And, you know, but then there's probably a downside there that you're not noticing. And it's a matter of that. It's not cut all that out. No, we can't do that. And that might seem difficult. And then there's people who want to go this way, or other people don't want it. You do that, and I don't want it. And but this is the human world. This goes on. But for each of us, watch your own mind. Notice what you're doing, and why you're if you're leaning this way or that way, see if you can realize what that is. And it's just simply not necessary to live that way. And I'm still, I've known this now for quite some time, but I'm still watching my mind, still catching myself, getting caught by one thing or another. It's endless work, but it can, I don't know, there's real joy in it as well. But that's not a, I'm not trying to give it a positive spin now. Anyway, nothing to say about any of it in the end, including what I just said there. So I don't know where's the... Okay, we have gone over, so... well, we had a late start, so I guess it wouldn't be too long here. Anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.